Hello, and welcome to Weekend Programming here on Radio Prague. I'm Jan Bellinger. Coming up in today's show, we have a new edition of Checkbooks hosted by David Vaughan. That'll be followed by Science Journal, and we'll round out the program with our long-running history series from the archives. First, though, let's go straight to Checkbooks. Not many people would give up the salary, status, and security of a job as a high-flying European lawyer for all the uncertainties of being a full-time writer. But this is exactly what Blanka Čechová has done. After several years working for international institutions that seem to feed on their own bureaucracy, she became disillusioned and instead has taken her experience as an inspiration for her writing. Her new novel, Total Balkan, draws richly from the time the author spent with an international mission in Kosovo, and the picture it paints is far from flattering. David Vaughan now meets a writer who has not been afraid to court controversy.
When she left school, it took Blanka Čechová a while before she decided whether to study law or journalism. But she concluded that as a lawyer, you can always start writing, but it is much harder for a writer to become a lawyer. It proved the right decision, as Blanka has fulfilled her own prediction. She is rapidly becoming an established voice on the Czech literary scene, writing with edge, pace and humour. On her blog, she also gives advice to other people struggling to take up writing as a full-time career. When I met Blanka Čechová, I began by asking her about her brief career as a lawyer.
I was 25 when I was admitted to the Czech division in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, which was a great honor for me at that time and a huge opportunity. However, I only stayed less than 2 years at the position, partly due to disillusion and loss of idealism, loss of certain illusions that I had about the international environment as such, not particularly about the court in Strasbourg.
You really felt when you went there that you could do something about human rights and it could make a little bit of an impact.
Obviously, you have this positive image of the institution before you join, so you have maybe exaggerated expectations regarding functionality and efficiency of the whole body and the system. So when you, for the first time in your life, confront a huge kind of Kafka mechanism that has its long procedures and often inefficient mechanisms, you are shocked, especially when you're 25.
And so what did you do after that?
Well, I thought that was the first and the last international organization that I would have anything in common with. But then I actually got already admitted to the University of Oxford to the creative writing program in the meantime. So for nearly half year, I was a full-time devoted student of creative writing. Then there was an opportunity to join a field mission in Kosovo, and it was the field mission of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I got to the position through a competition, and I didn't have much expectation that I would be successful. But as to my motivation, why after that partly disillusioning experience in Strasbourg, why did I choose to enter the competition, I thought that it must be very different to work in a field mission when you really have this operational space, maneuvering space of going out into the villages, working with people, implementing projects. I thought that that must be much more different than sitting in an office and working with papers and computer screens and judicial procedures.
And you tell the story of your experience in Kosovo through the book that you've just completed, which is highly critical of the way that international organizations function.
In the novel, I try to explore how actually can you coexist within an organization that sends you into a field mission like this. And you don't want to break the rules, yet you want to achieve something reasonable and sensible for the local people for whom you are there at the first place. And this exploration led me to some very interesting concepts. So on the platform of humor, I tried to show what eventually could be done. I'm not saying that I am the protagonist, absolutely not, even though it's very autobiographic.
The book's written in Czech, but you have translated some of it into English. So if maybe you could read a short extract.
I definitely could. Nevertheless, it will sound very different from the voice of the Czech original text because I never translated my own texts from Czech into English, and obviously this is just a working translation. If efficiency would be measured by the volume of printed paper, the democratization of South Serbian province of Kosovo would be the greatest success in modern history. Sadly, not every graphomaniac is a writer at the same time, even though many graphomaniacs can't be denied that within the huge amount they do come up with a reasonable thought from time to time. For instance, all the preambles, bearing in mind, recalling, regretting, determined, condemning and stipulating that Kosovo is to become the place where everyone, regardless of ethnicity, race or religion, can live and work without fear and danger, where freedom of movement is guaranteed and where justice prevails. About 1,500 items follow, explaining what exactly did the UN have on its mind. We will all be healthy and safe over here, the kids will go to school. There won't be power cuts, there will be water. No such things like drug smuggling or human trafficking will ever occur again. The courts will be prompt and fair, the police will act incorruptibly and duly, while we, the international community, will temporarily manage all that, and as soon as perfect order is established and a functioning multi-ethnic society inhabits Kosovo, we will return it back to Serbia, who in the meanwhile can sit back and relax. Just leave it up to us. Nice. Unnecessarily lengthy, though. If they said no way or just kidding, it would have been explicit enough. And whoever came up with the concept of functioning multi-ethnic society in Kosovo must have been either insane or horribly drunk, just like the guy who invented collectivization in Ukraine back then, and they should have reduced his legal capacity or simply hit him. Too bad that, again, he got away with it.
Aren't you being unfair? In a sense, it looks as though you're blaming the people who are trying against the odds to do something about a very, very difficult post-conflict situation for the fact that the situation is there and is virtually irresoluble.
Unfortunately, this is how I felt when I confronted the libraries of documents and libraries of concepts, policies, strategies, solutions for this tiny province of Kosovo, which has about 2 million inhabitants. But when you look around and you leave Pristina, which is obviously a big city and many things have changed to the better there, you go to the villages, you see power cuts, no fresh water, elementary schools in total ruins, unqualified teachers, doctors, often policemen and judges, you name it. So what I was aiming to do was to show the discrepancy between the amount of administrative work and policies and ideas and the actual result, because in the book there are many situations where the protagonist goes to the villages and does the actual field work and gets into the trap of communication with the local people and trying to explain that everybody is doing everything on paper, but actually it's very inefficient.
And one subject that also is brought up in your book is the question of corruption.
The protagonist in the beginning, when she is trying to decide whether she will take the position in Kosovo, she sees this piece of news where some spokesperson declares, we have built an alley of new houses and it is a huge success and there will be electricity and running water and the refugees will return there. And then she comes to Kosovo and she tries to find the place. She finds it and she realizes that there is nothing, that actually it was all Potemkin village. And she wonders how many times in the past when she was watching the news from much more distant places like Afghanistan or Sudan, it was manipulation or fabulation, because she cannot believe that somebody could just invent things that have origin in public budgets.
You have a very interesting and active blog, articles that you've written, short stories you've written, things that you've written about the process of writing and about your decision to leave what would have seemed to many to be a glittering career as a successful lawyer to become a writer with all the risks that involves. You write about all these things in your blog, and also there are a few things in English. Is that a medium where you really do feel at home?
It is, because it's entirely up to me what I write, how to write it. And of course, it has its negative sides as well, which mainly is discipline, because you have to organize your time and push yourself sometimes. But there are many readers of my blog, which really pleases me. And I think it has already helped several writers who are in the same position as myself, who are trying to find the ways how to exist as a full-time writer in the Czech environment, which is very difficult, because books, novels would typically be published in the volume of 2,000-3,000 copies. That's already very successful if you manage to sell 3,000 copies of a book here, a novel, as a relatively unknown author.
I found reading your work very refreshing, because it's very lively, it's very engaged writing, it's very fast. You tell stories, and you're quite close to journalism too, in much of what I've read of your writing. There aren't that many people in the Czech Republic, writers, who are writing like that at the moment. It would even be, there'll probably be quite a few who would actually look on it rather scornfully as saying, this isn't proper literature.
I think this approach to writing I developed very strongly in Oxford, where I think we were trained, if I can say, to write stories.
So the story isn't dead?
Oh no, definitely. I think, you know, if I can add to resuscitating it, I will do that. I still think that, if nothing else, it's much easier to be entertaining on the platform of a story, because it already gives you a structure that suggests certain things with which otherwise you have to really struggle.
And because you're writing about real places, real time, you're telling stories which are very close to your own experience, there must be some sort of process going on in your mind as to what extent you should allow your imagination to carry you away into the realm of fiction, away from documentary type writing, because you're talking about controversial things. If you're talking about corruption, for example, then there are questions that a reader might ask themselves, who are these corrupt people? What is it? This is, you know, she's writing about something that appears to have really happened. This must all go through your mind when you're writing, this kind of tension between fiction and documentary.
When I'm writing, I don't think it really occurs to me. I'm just trying to write a good story, bearing in mind the purpose why I'm choosing the topic, which is, in the case of Total Balkan, my aim to open up public discussion about the efficiency of international missions. That would be great if I could achieve that, but obviously the individual stories and some of the individual characters, they are fictional.
And where do you go from here?
Well, I was very lucky last year, because I got a novel commissioned from a big publishing house, and I already finished it, and now it's in its pre-printing phase, so hopefully in 1 month it will be out, and that will be a comedy or a humoristic novel from Croatia, so I'm still in the Balkans.
Can I ask what it's about, broadly?
Broadly, it is about a woman who comes to Croatia for a wedding of her friend. She comes as a witness, and she falls in love with a local man. And from the originally intended couple of days of staying there, she stays the whole summer. An important aspect of her stay over there is cooking, for several reasons, and she can't cook, so she's trying to learn to cook the local recipes, and people say that it's funny, so let's wait what the broader community of readers will say.
Is there anything more that we can look forward to in English?
Since I specialized in screenwriting in the last year of my Oxford master, I have two scripts in English that now are circulating around screenwriting competitions and two production companies. So let's wait. What do they say?
Blanka Čechová, best of luck with all those projects.
Well, thank you very much.
And you can find a link to Blanka Čechová's blog from our website.
You've been listening to Czech Books, in which David Vaughan talked to author Blanka Čechová, whose new novel is Total Balkan. If you'd like to comment on that program, anything you've heard so far, please do so by writing to us here at Radio Prague. The address is english@radio.cz if you'd like to contact us over the internet, or perhaps take part also in discussion on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll also find our station. Now, though, let's move on to this edition of Science Journal, this time hosted by Sara Borufka. In this month's edition, a team of Czech researchers may have found the answer to a question that has puzzled veterinarians, horse breeders and biologists for decades. Why such a high percentage of pregnancies in mares end in natural, chemically triggered abortions? A recent study released by a Czech scientist suggests the answer may be that keeping pregnant mares close to stallions at their home stable makes them more likely to abort.
I'm giving her carrot, which she apparently loves.
Dr. Ludek Bartosz feeds a mare at a stable on the outskirts of Prague. Female horses are also the subject of his latest study into the question of the species' high abortion rates. Dr. Bartosz's team from the Institute of Animal Science in the Czech Republic recently published their surprising findings in the journal Behavioral Ecology and Sociology.
We found evidence that bringing a mare for mating out of her home stable and bringing her then back when she is already pregnant to an environment containing stallion or gelding increases probability for abortion.
It is common practice among horse breeders to send mares away from their home stable to be mated with stallions. But once pregnant, the new study suggests, they often engage in promiscuous sex with the males when they return to their home stable.
The mare is trying to mate with the local stallion to convince him that her future foal is actually his. When she fails to attract him or to get into contact with him, she aborts.
This peculiar sexual behavior may have evolved as a response of certain species to infanticide, when a new dominant male in the group will kill the offspring of other males. However, the high abortion rate amongst horses has puzzled experts for a long time.
This has been a question for generations of veterinarians for about 40 years. The average percentage of abortions is reaching 40%, which is unusually high in comparison to other domestic ungulates such as cattle, pigs, goats, sheep, etc.
Chemically triggered abortions do not just occur in horses. Dr. Bartosz and his team of researchers were inspired by a discovery of zoologist Hilda Ambrus.
Originally we thought, or we were inspired by a so-called Bruce effect, which was discovered on mice in the late 50s of the last century. It was like this, when a pregnant mouse comes into contact with either a dominant male or just scent of him throughout his urine, she aborts. And it took maybe 40 years until they discovered the principle, and several teams globally had to contribute into these principles. When the female is sniffing urine from the dominant, the strange dominant male, she gets pheromones contained in the urine into her Jacobson organ, which is the organ analyzing pheromones. This triggers the whole cascade of processes leading to changes in prolactin profiles resulting in abortions. So originally we were expecting the same, but in our case it cannot be like that just because those whose incidence of abortion is the highest were actually physically isolated from the males, so that they couldn't come in touch with urine.
In the case of horses, mares may abort foals even if they are kept close to male horses that have been castrated.
Not too many breeders have a real stallion, and this is perhaps also a very important question, that the mare doesn't distinguish if the male who is present is intact male, which is stallion, or castrated male, which is gelding. So it's very common having mares and geldings. And we found out that the effect of the gelding is equal to stallion.
Dr. Bartosz's study, based on a survey of 100 Czech horse breeders, suggests that the current breeding practices may be the reason for this high incidence of abortions. If pregnant mares are close to but physically separated from a stallion or gelding, and therefore unable to disguise the origin of their offspring, they will abort their foals. But breeders are hesitant to adjust their techniques to the findings, says Dr. Bartosz.
At this stage, we have already been approached by various breeders, but the question is usually, what should we do?
And what is your answer to that question?
Well, the answer doesn't make them happy, because it's quite obvious the best way is to keep the horse and a stallion at the same environment for the whole period of reproduction.
However, for most breeders, this is an inconceivable notion. Horse pregnancies last 11 months, and keeping the stallion with the mare for this period would be very expensive. Another possibility would then be to allow mares to mate with males at their home stable. Lenka Skopa, who breeds her horses using this technique, says she expects other breeders will be slow to embrace Dr. Bartosz's findings.
I think that breeders will perceive this as very problematic, because very few would be ready to lend a stallion to another stable. So I can understand that stud farm owners do not like this method of breeding, do not have an understanding for it, and do not want to support it.
Dr. Bartosz says he has been overwhelmed by the great response to his study from both the scientific community and the international media.
To my greatest surprise, this has got a huge audience in the scientific world. This was based, first of all, on press release of the publisher of the journal, which is Springer, who publishes quite a lot of scientific journals, including ours. Well, ours, where we published this study, which is Behavioral Ecology and Social Biology. And through this public release, we got to BBC, to a New Scientist, to some of the American magazine, the same in Denmark. And when you search the trace of this public release and the subsequent places, you can find maybe 100 addresses globally. So the response is really unbelievable, high and huge.
But while the scientific community was quick to embrace the study, Dr. Bartosz says that horse breeders were rather hesitant.
We have very variable responses. First of all, we had the chance to present our data in Kladruby, which is famous place with old Kladruby horse breeds. I would say it depended more or less on the age of the breeder. Those of my age, which means very experienced breeders, they were quite surprised and then they didn't take it too seriously. On the contrary, we got very positive response from younger breeders who were at least interested what might be the principle of the whole thing.
But even with some of the younger breeders interested in the results of his study, he says it's hard to say how much actual impact his groundbreaking research will have on breeding techniques.
I would say my ambitions are not too high. I would be absolutely happy if breeders started thinking about the biology of their horses. It would be too nice if they accepted this and applied it into practice straight on.
Dr. Bartosz and his team are planning to further expand their research into the phenomenon of abortions in mares and shed light on additional factors that may influence their occurrence.
We haven't finished with this, of course. We have a lot of ideas how to proceed with horses. For me, I should say it's some sort of, bad part of this is that I have spent all my life studying deer. This result came from horses, but let's say this is ungulate and it's not that far away, but I'm still expecting to have equal quality of the result of my beer.
And that edition of Science Journal was produced by Sarah Borufka and was first aired in May of last year, 2011. Now we're going to move on to our long-running history series from the archives, hosted by David Vaughan.
In the 1970s, the Cold War was fought on many fronts. One of them was Northern Ireland, where the tension and violence that raged throughout the decade also became part of the propaganda war between East and West. At the time, Czechoslovak Radio's correspondent in London was Karel Kvapil, who had entered the radio after the wave of sackings following the 1968 Soviet-led invasion, and later went on to become its last communist-era general director. In 1977, Kvapil travelled to Belfast to report on the Troubles. For part of his programme, he spoke with women on a housing estate in a mainly Catholic area of the city.
I saw a soldier with his gun, with a baton, and he was beating this boy like that. He was beating him, the boy had no shirt on him. Then I realised...
How old was he, but?
In 20s, early 20s. They beat another son.
Communist Czechoslovakia was firmly on the Republican side in the conflict, and Karel Kvapil's report was keen to portray the situation in terms of class rather than sectarian struggle. So perhaps it is not surprising that he interviewed the head and founder of the Communist Party of Ireland, Michael O'Riordan, a veteran Irish politician who had fought in the Spanish Civil War. Here is a short extract.
The British government liked to pose as a guardian of democracy and human rights, but I don't remember any British politician raising publicly his voice and condemning the torture of ordinary people in Northern Ireland. Isn't it proof of hypocrisy of the British government?
Well, if I say that we regard the British government as the most hypocritical government on earth, I don't say it from any sense of national, chauvinist, subjective reaction to the British presence in Ireland. I think I would be reflecting what is the experience of the Irish people, that we've always seen the role of Britain as one of not only of imposing terror on our people, but have been master hands in the terms of hypocrisy.
And what steps do you think should be taken to bring peace to people in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think a very important thing in arriving at peace in Northern Ireland is the unity of the working class, the organised working class. Also, I think what is very, very important is the alliance between the Irish working class and the British working people. Because we are the country about which Marx made the famous statement that no country can be free which oppresses another. And this is classical in relation to Britain and the Ireland itself. The technique of what the British call counterinsurgency has been developed in Northern Ireland, not only for use against the Irish people, but also for possible use against their own peoples in capitalist Europe itself. The other point, this makes the point, I suppose, that there is a need to internationalise the support of the working people of Europe. And we would like to express our appreciation of the help, the sympathy, and the solidarity expressed by the socialist peoples of working peoples of the socialist countries, peoples of the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia and GDR, who have come out clearly in helping to expose the British internationally in their alleged campaign for the as peacekeepers in our country and as ones who are the first-class champions of human rights, etc., etc.
The leader of the Communist Party of Ireland, Michael O'Riordan, talking to Czechoslovak Radio's Karel Kvapil in 1977. Michael O'Riordan died in 2006 at the age of 89. Karel Kvapil's brief tenure as General Director of Czechoslovak Radio ended in December 1989 with the collapse of the communist regime.
You've been listening to From the Archives with David Vaughan, which brings us to the end of today's program. I'm Jan Wellinger. For all of us here at Radio Prague, thanks so much for joining us, and take care.